She says she's running to transform the way Florida looks at guns, marijuana, and more. Good morning. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is 89.9. Thanks for listening to the show. And coming up, we speak with Agriculture Commissioner candidate Nikki Fried. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a look ahead to this week's Lights On After School event, plus engaging seniors at the beaches. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, she's an attorney and a lobbyist for medical marijuana, running to replace Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam. Nikki Fried says she wants to transform the state's Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services on everything from cannabis to gun regulation and more. Fried, a Democrat, faces State Representative Matt Caldwell in the November 6th election, and she joins us now by phone. Nikki Fried, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me this morning.
And what are your questions for candidate Nikki Fried? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And you've gotten a lot of attention in this run-up to the midterms in a couple of weeks, Nikki, particularly over the issue of medical marijuana. You want to move the state's oversight of medical marijuana into the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Although there are lots of other issues in this race, this is one I think that you're becoming known for. You're a lobbyist for medical marijuana. And you said you decided to run because you felt the state was not executing the will of the people when the voters chose to approve medical marijuana in the state. So specifically, what would you change in terms of how the state regulates and manages medical marijuana sales and production?
Yeah, you know, first of all, you know, the fact that both the legislature and the Department of Health and Governor Scott's administration didn't implement the will of the people. And that's what kind of I saw firsthand how Tallahassee was broken. If they couldn't implement something that was going to help patients across our state, I believe that it was time for a change, and that's why I decided to run. Some of the things that I wanted to change, and I see, is that, you know, so many hoops that our patients and our doctors have to go through in order to get onto the registry. The fact that we have caps on the amount of retail locations across the state means a lot of our patients in rural communities don't have access. And we have an opiate problem here across the state and across the country, people that are overdosing and on numerous amounts of pharmaceutical drugs and have an opportunity to have access to medical marijuana, but yet the state's not implementing it. You know, we have rules that are supposed to have been out a year ago, and it's just prolonging between lawsuit after lawsuit. Currently, we are in appeals process for not allowing our patients to actually take the raw flower. And so these are the types of things that the governor's office and the legislature just put up all these roadblocks in the way of patient access that needs to be changed and fixed and make sure the will of the people is finally implemented and our patients have access to these products.
What are some specific steps that you would take as Agriculture Commissioner to expedite that access?
You know, first of all, you know, you are correct. So currently, the Department of Agriculture only oversees three of the components to medical marijuana. So I'd go in and first and foremost, make sure that the elements that I do oversee, which is pesticides and fertilizers, as well as edibles, which is one of the components that I've been saying you should have been done 2 years ago. I would put out the rules for the edibles on day one of my administration and then start talking to the governor about moving over some of the responsibilities to my office and working with the legislature to do so as well. And so those are just a couple of things to start moving it over. But working with the legislature, we just saw that some of the courts have said that some of the parts of our current law that was implemented is unconstitutional. The legislature is going to have to go back in and fix this program because the fact that, you know, a court is now saying that what we've done is unconstitutional, it shows light that we as patients and we as the people of our state believe that what has been done is not the right path forward.
549-2937 to connect with candidate Nikki Fried. We hope to have her opponent, State Representative Matt Caldwell, the Republican in this race, on the show before Election Day as well. Let's talk about gun regulation. You've been critical of the outgoing Ag Commissioner Adam Putnam about how his department oversaw the handling of concealed weapons permits. There has been some controversy about mishandling of that. What would you change in terms of the protocol for handling weapons permits in the state of Florida and the issue of gun regulation, you know, more broadly?
Yeah, I think it's three things. One is to go in and actually do a full audit. What exactly happened? We don't know. We have just bits and pieces of information, so I need to be able to go in there and feel like we have done an audit, that we are not missing any of the balls that were dropped. And I want to also start the conversation of actually moving the responsibility to law enforcement. That way, politics doesn't get in the way. It is purely they go through, they do the background checks. And we've also seen that, you know, since the primary, over 300 emails were released where the NRA had complete oversight and influence in the regulation of the concealed weapons permit and gun licensing. And so you move it over to law enforcement and make sure that's done right, you take politics out of this. You know, this is such a serious issue in our state. You know, we have a unique opportunity to make a difference and to make sure that the lives of our citizens are not at risk because of politics. This isn't a partisan issue. This is something that every single citizen in our state should want to have happen. It's a complete background check of those individuals who are going to get hunting licenses, of those who are going to get concealed weapons permitting. And I think that this is a call for action that must happen to protect the citizens of our state.
Now, you say it's not a partisan issue, but when it comes to the Second Amendment and guns, people do fall along sharply partisan lines. You're a Democrat, and you're campaigning on a policy of tighter gun regulation. What's your strategy to reach out to voters who this is the issue that they care the most about? They're more conservative voters. They vote in every election specifically because they care so much about gun rights and the rights that inherent in the Second Amendment. And they resist any attempt to change what they see as an infringement on those rights.
And we're not, and I'm not proposing that at all. What I'm saying is that we need to be doing our jobs. Doing background checks is not a partisan issue. You talk to any of the conservatives out there that are listening, and they're going to agree that making sure that the right people are having the guns and the wrong people don't. And that's from background checks. And so that's not partisan. And what I tell everybody is that I'm not, I myself have a concealed weapons permit. I own a gun. For self-defense purposes, so I am not looking to infringe. I'm an attorney, so I am, you know, bound to support the Second Amendment. So all I'm doing is saying that we need to do a better check on our government to make sure that we are protecting our citizens, and that's doing thorough background checks. And if that means moving it over to law enforcement to do this to make sure that we are doing it properly, then that's a rational basis to do so. Not infringing upon anybody's rights. If you should be qualified to have a concealed weapons permit or a hunting license, then you're going to get one. As clear and simple as that.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Nikki Fried, the Democrat running to replace Adam Putnam as the state's agriculture commissioner. What are your questions for her? Give us a call at 549-2937. Now, you've been on this program before, Nikki, talking about the fact that not only would you be overseeing agriculture, but also consumer services in the state of Florida. It's a huge agency, and it oversees so many aspects of life in the Sunshine State. One of the issues that has gotten a lot of attention and criticism is the state's do not call solicitation list. You know, people have joked that whichever candidate is perceived as being able to stop the unwanted phone calls might be the winner, whether it's you or your opponent, Matt Caldwell. This is a big issue for Floridians who feel like they're being harassed, even scammed by a lot of these calls. How would you change the way the consumer wing of this agency handles the do not call list?
Yeah, we all probably have 30 or 40 numbers locked on our phones. And I feel horrible for those who are getting these phone calls, which is all of us, and especially some of our seniors and those who are on minute-by-minute plans. This is harassment, absolutely. And what I would do is, first of all, you know, as a 15-year practicing attorney, protecting consumers and taxpayers for most of my legal career, this has come as part of what I've been doing for my career. And so part of it is making sure that we are responsive. You know, right now I've been hearing stories all across our state that when somebody calls in to the commissioner's office to report a number, there's no one on the other line. They leave messages and they don't get any return phone calls. So one is to beef up staff. To be looking into and investigating these, to actually have somebody on the other line to be taking down these. And then it's beefing up our security and our technology. You know, we know that, you know, the people out there that are frauding our consumers are smart, we need to be smarter. We need to make sure that we have some of the best technology and that we're going in and actually making a difference and then prosecuting these individuals and these companies. Once we get a name and we start prosecuting them and holding them accountable, there will be a ripple effect across our state.
Okay, let's go to a few calls now for Nikki Fried. It's 549-2937. Patrice on the north side. Hi, Patrice. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. So great to talk to you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, good to have you on the show.
Yes, I wanted to ask Mrs. Fried, how would she work in conjunction with Andrew Gillum and Senator Bill Nelson in order to make her goals for the state of Florida bear fruit?
Yeah, thanks for that. You know, Nikki Fried, if you're victorious, certainly your campaign platform will have greater chance of success if your fellow Democrats win those races, particularly Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, if he's elected governor, rather than if you'd be working with a Governor Ron DeSantis, the Republican. So what about that?
Yeah, you know, I am somebody from my entire life. My dad's Republican. My mom is a Democrat. I was told and taught at a very early age that good policy comes through, you know, coming to the center on issues. And so that's what I've done. You know, when I spent my time in Tallahassee and passing some great legislation for our foster care kids and public education, we had to cross party lines and work together for good policy. And so I would do that regardless if it was Andrew in there or Ron. It is to work together to come up with good policy. And I have a track record of doing so. I have friends on both sides of the aisle. Incoming Speaker and Senate President are also individuals that I've worked alongside with over the years for policy purposes, and that wouldn't change. I'm somebody who has an open-door policy, like to bring people to the table and work through issues, and I'm somebody who doesn't like to play partisan politics. I'm somebody who likes to get things done.
It would be remarkable if, say, we had a Democratic governor with some Republican cabinet members or vice versa. Say you win your race and you're working with a Republican governor. That could present some interesting challenges on some of these issues, given that the Republican, Mr. DeSantis, is far more conservative on all of these issues than you or any of the other Democrats running for these statewide offices. Is there common ground to be found? The parties are so far apart on all of these issues.
There's always common ground. You know, I firmly believe that everybody, if they're coming in to the elected positions to do what's best for the state of Florida, we may differ on what that looks like. But if your heart is in the right place, we're going to find compromise. And, you know, it may be a little bit longer than, you know, if I had my fellow Democrats on the cabinet, but I can guarantee you that there's going to be compromise to be had, because we want what's best for the state of Florida, and stagnation isn't what's best. And so we're going to work through these issues. But I have no doubt that regardless of who's in the cabinet, we're going to be able to work together.
Nashawn on the north side. Nashawn, hello. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for Ms. Nikki, and please let me know if this falls under your realm or scope. My concern on the north side of Jacksonville is urban farming. And then another concern of mine is that we are a port city here in Jacksonville, and I was concerned about commodities and export to be able to generate some type of gainful employment for the citizens in the north quarter of Jacksonville, and to see if that fell under your scope if you were elected.
Thanks for both. Yeah, good question. Thank you.
Sure. The first part is absolutely that the urban farming would definitely fall under my privy. And I talk a lot about, too, and I've actually had some roundtables up at near neck of the woods with Senator Nelson's office, dealing a lot with our food deserts across our country and across our state, and trying to figure out ways that we can work together with the Department of Agriculture, your local communities, and really having a community farming available to kind of start combating some of these food deserts, which is such an important aspect. You know, most of our kids, you know, go to school and have one meal a day and then are walking home and don't have an opportunity to have fresh produce either at home or even on the way because there's no food stores around. There's not being convenience stores. And so having that kind of community and relationship and figuring out new solutions for gardening and for community farms to really go after some of these food deserts that are happening in a lot of our rural and urban communities. So that definitely would fall under my purview. And as far as support, I don't have a lot of say in what kind of comes in per se, because that's more of a federal, but I certainly will be a huge advocate to allow, you know, to make sure that we're using Jacksport and Mayport for a lot of the commodities coming into our areas, because you are absolutely right that it creates jobs, and we need to make sure that we are on that list in the national level to have our commodities being shipped in to our ports and make sure that we are the ones, instead of Savannah, let's make sure we're getting into Jackson and Mayport.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. You've also taken a lot of questions in this race on water quality issues and climate change, although that's not under your specific purview as the state's agriculture commissioner. Certainly, this is something that you'll follow closely. Here's a tweet for you from a listener. Climate change is a big issue in Florida. How are we going to educate the deniers and bring science and evidence-based facts to the multitude of them that live in our state?
Well, I you know, it's going to come down to, you know, we believe in science. And if you go down to South Florida and see how the sea level is rising down there, and every time that we have a storm, more and more water is coming through our storm drainage. And the fact, you can't deny that, you know, Michael came up and then the awful hurricane because of the water being so much more heated out in the Gulf. That's climate change. And we need to be working on, you know, not so much, people are going to believe what they're going to believe. It's up to us, of those who are going to be in elected office, to start putting science first and coming up with solutions based on this, and make sure that we are doing everything we can to protect our shores, to make sure that our beautiful beaches are protected, and that we have a state for people to come to in generations. And that's only by addressing some of these issues that are going to impact our state in the near future. And if we're not impacting it, you know, people are going to leave our coastal communities, which means that the property values are going to decrease, which means that we have less taxable revenue for our local government, and which means it kind of is a trickle-down effect. And so we need to be addressing these issues today because we don't have time the next 10 years to be figuring these out.
As agriculture commissioner, what are specific steps you could take in this area?
You know, some of it is figuring out, you know, how this impacts agriculture and making sure that there's new technologies being utilized from our agriculture community, and to be educating our farmers of these new technologies and how they're impacting our environment, and making sure, like, and I talk about too, like, other alternative crops that are better for the environment, that are using less water, like industrial hemp that uses less water, yet less fertilizers, less impact on our environment. And so it's working with our local farming community for education, working with them on new technologies, new research, and then using also our resources for sustainable and reusable water, because we know that that's going to be also impacted as climate continues to change.
Standralyn in Argyle. Standralyn, is that your name? Go ahead.
Yes, Standralyn. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is one of economic impact. So I hear a lot of the candidates talk about, and Ms. Freed, I love your ideas on updating the technology and making sure that we're entering despite, you know, with the most up-to-date resources. But, you know, there's a old phrase, if it were easy, everyone would do it. So there's a lot of things that we do, but there's a definite economic impact. Could you tell us about the strategies, the economic strategies that you're looking at to pay for all of the things that you like to do coming into this office?
Sure. I mean, we have a return on investment, you know, that I also want, you know, once we start putting more resources and technology in this, in the long run, it's going to be return on investment. It's going to be better for our environment. And a lot of this is, again, education. You know, I've seen other countries utilize this advanced technology, whether it's for solar, whether it's for agriculture, whether it's for water, reusable water. And it's a matter of, you know, putting on, you know, I'm a fighter. And, you know, people may, you know, as you're just close to said, you know, people are reluctant for change. But I'm somebody who that answer isn't acceptable to me. Our environment is changing. Our technology is changing. And we have to change along with it. And we need to reprioritize our budget. You know, there's a $1.8 billion department that I'd be overseeing, and I will be doing I'll be making sure that we go through it with a small comb and to see where are all of the fluff is in the budget, and reprioritize to make sure that we are going into the next generation with the best resources and the best technologies. And it's about leadership.
particularly candidates like you are running on a change theme. Florida has been under Republican control for 20 years now, and there are a number of Democratic candidates running for statewide office this cycle, including, as you mentioned, Andrew Gillum and others running for the cabinet positions, who are just running, in addition to all these specific issues we've talked about, what you're asking voters to do is to hand the keys over in Tallahassee to another political party. Certainly Democrats are going to vote for that. Republicans, for the most part, aren't. So what is your strategy to reach those who are undecided, really, who, you know, they might be open to a change message, but they're not Democrats or Republicans, and they're still deciding who they might vote for?
Our state is not in the right direction. You know, we've got green algae coming out of Lake Okeechobee. We have red tide on both of our coasts. You know, medical marijuana wasn't implemented properly. Amendment 1, trying to save our environment and our land, wasn't implemented. You know, people all over the state are frustrated. And, you know, every time that I've talked to, you know, I talk to independents, I talk to Republicans, they're equally as frustrated. You know, in fact, when I talk to our coastal communities, which is predominantly Republican in the southern part of our state, they're the ones who have been the most impacted by the red tide and the green algae. And they want that fixed. And they see that under the current administration, under Governor Scott, who cut $700 million to DEP, and the fact that we've seen rollback on regulations to the pollution that's going into Lake Okeechobee, they're fed up too. And they want to see this change, and they want to make things better. And then we even saw, again, back onto the concealed weapons permitting. You know, that was a major mistake and negligence by a current commissioner. This is not partisan stuff. We all drink the same water. We all eat the same food. We all live in the same state of Florida. And they want individuals, and they're not caring about a partisan. They want to know who is going to stand up for them, who is going to make their lives better, who's going to protect their environment. And we are seeing a lot of people crossing over because they believe in the mission that we have and the vision that we have for the state of Florida. And I'm talking to independents and to Republicans every single day, and they are seeing that a change is okay, because what is happening now, the status quo, is not working.
Let's go to a few more calls for Nikki Fried. Rusty at the Beaches. Hi, Rusty. Good morning.
Hey. Good morning. I didn't come in on the beginning of the conversation, but you're one of the people that I have voted for, and my reasoning is we need some new blood in the agricultural department because we have so much squandering of our resources. And my understanding of the agricultural department and our water management is that they're supposed to conserve or preserve these resources. I live 30 years in Orlando. The water that is wasted on resort locations there is criminal, considering our efforts now to get more fresh water, our fear of running out of fresh water. And I don't see our resources being managed properly by the current administration. And when Governor Scott came into office, we had just gotten a control over unbridled growth, urban sprawl. And then he repealed all of these measures that would have required builders and developers to put in the infrastructure to support the traffic and the people that their community was going to bring. To go into Orlando, on the east side of Orlando, you can't move around over there because of the thousands of homes that were put in there without roads to support those homes. It's and I see the same thing happening here in Jacksonville. Mm.
Thanks for that, Rusty. Nikki Fried.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. We're seeing this, and we know that in the next 10 years, we're going to have a water deficiency. And so if we don't do something today to capture our water, to store our water, make sure that it's reusable, we're going to have some serious problems. And yes, agriculture uses a significant amount of water, and we need to do our part in the agriculture community to be storing our waters on land. I've talked about long-term permitting for some of our larger agricultural areas. To be utilizing a regional approach to store their water on their property to be able to be used from the locals that are around there. But you're absolutely right that we have to reprioritize what we are doing here in our state and giving a lot of our farmers. You know, we've seen, you know, how much NAFTA, which is now USMCA, and how much our trade wars are hurting our agriculture community. We've seen citrus greening and canker has been hurting, you know, our ag community.
And we need to be creating alternative resources and alternative technology and crops to make sure that they're utilizing their property and not having to sell it to developers because the cost is just too much for them.
Rod in St. Augustine. Hey, Rod. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Ms. Melissa. How you doing, man?
Okay, how are you? Go ahead.
Fine. I was calling. I know when Adam Putnam was the commissioner, one of the things that I noticed, he was over, like, the gas pricing. My question I wanted to ask Ms. Free is that who controls the, you know, you're in the same city and the gas price is $2 here and you go right around the corner and it's $2.50. My question would be, who controls that and what can we do as citizens to have a better say-so about that?
Yeah. Thanks for that. You know, people are always worried they're getting gouged on prices for gas and other commodities. Your agency, if you win, would oversee that. What about that part of the job?
Yeah, so you know, we oversee some of the regulations to make sure that, you know, that the right stations are up and that the skimmers that we know that we're all being frauded from the skimmers and safety aspects of the gas stations. When it comes to actually fraud of the gas station pump, a lot of that prosecution comes from the Attorney General's office to make sure that our local gas owners are not taking advantage of our consumers, especially during emergency situations like hurricanes. I mean, we all saw that. I mean, I'm from South Florida, and I saw it through the last couple of hurricane cycles, just seeing how much the gas prices just, you know, go through the roof around emergencies. So a lot of that is reporting it to the Attorney General. I oversee the skimmers at the gas station pumps, the safety and the consumer aspect of it. But it's something that we all work on together because this is, again, something that affects all of us every single day.
And finally, this agency oversees such a vast, far-flung array of issues in Florida. Do you think it's too big, too unwieldy, you know, consumer and agriculture all under one bucket?
Yeah, I think that if you have the right leader at the helm of the office, it can be done. And to make sure that our priorities are set straight, it is definitely an enormous position. And a position that has not gotten the type of attention that is necessary. So I do believe that it is huge, but with the right type of leadership, the right type of perspective and vision for the state, it can be accomplished.
Nikki Fried, running for Agriculture Commissioner in Florida. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Nikki Fried is the Democrat in this race. We hope to have the Republican candidate, her opponent, State Representative Matt Caldwell from Southwest Florida, on this program before Election Day. Early voting is underway now. Get out and vote. And much more still ahead later. How seniors at the beaches can engage at any age, we'll tell you about it. But up next, helping kids succeed once the dismissal bell rings. It's lights on after school. Back soon.
Story to tell? Since 2003, StoryCorps has been collecting and archiving stories from all over the country. From November 18th to December 21st, StoryCorps will be right here in Jacksonville. StoryCorps is the two-time Peabody Award-winning nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share humanity's stories. If you've ever listened to their NPR program, you know how powerful and touching these stories can be. To find out how StoryCorps can record your story, go to wjct.org/events.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Well, Jacksonville city leaders recently convened a task force, or are looking to do that, to study ways to reduce violent crime in the city. It's kind of ironic given that the city of Jacksonville already did that over a decade ago during an exhaustive process. It was called the Jacksonville Journey. Remember that? And one of the findings from that era that they could simply repurpose is a common sense one. After school programs do a lot to help kids stay on track and out of trouble. And there are many successful ones doing great work all around town. Now, local organizations will celebrate 20 years of city-funded after-school programs later this week during a nationwide event. It's called Lights On After School. Leon Baxton is Chief Operating Officer at Communities in Schools of Jacksonville, and he's here now. Hey, Leon, good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. Okay, so we'll talk about the event in a moment, but first, let's look back a little ways. Communities in Schools started some after-school programs in this city some 20 years ago, and they've been running ever since. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Jacksonville was one of 20 cities chosen for a 21st Century Community Service Grant. And Communities in Schools applied to this grant through the school district. And back then it was called the Jacksonville Children's Commission. And we won four schools back then. It was Eugene Butler, Northwestern, Rebalt, and Gilbert. And those programs are still in existence today. And now Communities in Schools is up to 22 after-school programs. And we're just excited. This is an exciting time for me, being part of it and looking back 20 years and seeing where we are now.
Well, you must be doing something right if they're still going. What makes them so successful?
The success has been a partnership with the Duval County Public School System, the City of Jacksonville through the Kids Hope Alliance, the City of Jacks, the mayor, the sheriff, and everybody working together for one cause. And one of the key reasons why the program is still going is because of the success. We know that after-school programs with students who attend regularly do better academically, get promoted on a higher level, and there's less behavior because they're engaged in great activities after school.
Right. Keeping kids engaged after the dismissal from school does so much to help them academically. It helps them stay out of trouble with the law. It's a really small investment that has a big payoff.
Yes, and it's very helpful to the parents, too. We're in some of the most challenged neighborhoods and some of the most challenged schools, and many of the parents work 2 to 3 jobs. And so we're keeping them busy and engaged and safe after school. We also provide a snack as well as a hot meal. And for middle schools, we make sure we bus them home because, you know, leaving at about 7 o'clock can be quite dangerous to be walking through certain neighborhoods.
So there's a unique approach, too, with Communities in Schools that differs a little bit from some other programs. I think it's why it stood the test of time. What's unique about your approach?
We've focused more on workforce development. We're more academically focused as well. This particular year, we have STEM or robotics teams in every one of our programs. STEM, science, technology, education, STEM, science, technology,
engineering, and math. All the stuff I was bad at.
Exactly. It's the wave of the future. And with these robotics teams, we're teaching kids how to build robots and become engineers. And there's a shortage of engineers right now, so we're very excited about that. We also are doing more trips to businesses to expose kids to different variety of vocational activities.
Now, this program started with a few hundred students. Now you serve more than 5,000 students.
Yes, and that's just Communities in Schools. Kids Hope Alliance funds over 67 programs. We have 22 of them. So we're reaching a large number of students. However, there's still thousands of students who can benefit from after-school programs.
Sure. The need is so great. And as we've been talking a lot in recent months, once again, about the gun violence and the high crime rate in the city of Jacksonville, I think back to the Jacksonville Journey era, mm-hmm. when then Mayor John Payton mm-hmm. became so distraught by the gun violence that he mm-hmm. convened this massive citywide initiative, the Jacksonville Journey, mm-hmm. where a lot of people put a lot of time and effort into looking at an interlocking approach to reducing crime and strengthening mm-hmm. families. Mm-hmm. And this was a key part of it. After school programs.
Right.
Do you think the city could do more in this area?
I think they're trying to do more. They're attempting to do more. Back then with the journey, you know, it's focused on, they called it PIE, prevention, intervention, and enforcement. And I believe Mayor Payton during that time increased the after school programs. And they have increased somewhat over the last few years. But yes, I think the mayor now, working with the sheriff and everybody in the school district, understand that we have to increase the services even more. And they're working hard to do it. It's very challenging the last few months here in Jacksonville. But with a concerted effort with not just the mayor, the city, the schools, but the community coming together as well to address these issues.
Now, you mentioned the Kids Hope Alliance, which has sort of supplanted the Jacksonville Children's Commission. Mm-hmm. Is the model still the same? Is the funding still the same, or have there been changes for you?
The funding, they're still very highly focused on after school program, which is great. They understand the importance of it. They're expanding. They want to get more parents involved. They want to get more involved with those students who may have dropped out of school and do more intervention. So I'm definitely in support of the changes that are coming, and with more mental health services, because when you have these kids who live in areas where there's a lot of violence, they're coming to school and it's hard to focus on them. So the Kids Hope Alliance is heading in the right direction and building on the successes of the Children's Commission and the journey.
You're working with kids who are poor, hungry. They are coming from neighborhoods that aren't often safe. They are dealing with negative peer pressure, learning disabilities, mm-hmm. a whole host of things. Mm-hmm. So these kids are challenged in many ways. They mm-hmm. they need every bit of support they can get.
Yes. I myself was a child of, I lost my mother to a heroin overdose at 10, was on welfare, but it was the caring adults who got into my life and helped me become who I am today. I graduated from high school and went on to college. And what these after-school programs and the services that communities and schools offer through literacy, case management, and after-school provide caring adults that are on the campuses with these students. And we know that students are resilient. They can overcome a lot of their challenges if they have the caring adult and the support. And that's what these after-school programs are providing.
Yeah, and you're living proof of that. This is so personal for you. I didn't know that about you before now.
Yes, yes. And it's my heart, 20 years. And here's the thing, looking back, I'm running into students now who have graduated from college, who are pharmacists, who are bankers, and one of particular case, Dominique Cummings, is back with us, is on our board of directors, and is a mentor back in the program at Gilbert, which started back in 1998. So it's great to see the return on investment.
We're talking about Lights On After School later this week in Jacksonville with Leon Baxton of Communities and Schools. Scott is in downtown Jacksonville. He's on the line. Scott, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. How you doing? My concern here, very shortly, briefly, is that I hear what he's saying, but I'm reading the data. And what he is saying does not match the data.
How do you mean?
That's my concern here.
How do you mean?
Well, I'm saying that I see empirical evidence that what he's saying and what's taking place in these communities, why do we need to continue to pay for 220? And I'm a member of the Jacksonville Journey. I was on the team, on the task.
I was on a committee too, Scott.
Yes. Yes, I know. but what I'm saying, I'm out in these communities. I'm all over Jacksonville, but definitely on the north side. And what he's saying and what's going on in these communities does not match up. And I don't think we have enough time.
Are you saying that we shouldn't have after school programs for kids?
No, it shouldn't be no after school program. The school really should start when the parents go to work and stay in these schools until the parents get off from work.
Well, I think that's basically what goes on.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate your call, Scott, but I think that's basically what they're doing.
Exactly. And I understand Scott's frustration. I know Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
I know him very well.
You know Scott. Okay. So then if you understand his point of view, what's your answer to Scott?
The answer to Scott is that we're not reaching enough of the students, the people who need the help. And that's where the funding has to come in at. There's still 30,000 students that can benefit from after-school programs in our community, and not just after-school, mental health and all the services. If we're going to make a difference, we have to make a concerted effort with funding and really serving the entire community. So, but right now, funding has always been an issue. We want to do more, but it is an issue. So it is frustrating because I live on the north side as well.
Lights on after school. Let's talk about that. Happening this Thursday. This is a nationwide event. We will have several local observances. What's Lights on After School?
Lights on After School is a national event where all after school programs, lights are on, and they're celebrating the importance of after school programs and the roles they play in kids' lives. Not only in kids' life, but helping the parents who, many of our parents these days are struggling working 2 to 3 jobs. And the after school programs have provided a safe haven for these kids to learn academically, be engaged in enrichment activities, and stay in school and do well. And that's the whole purpose of it. And it's not going away. After school programs will be here for years to come. And people really appreciate it. We get the support from parents. We get the support from the school district, as well as Kids Hope Alliance, the mayor, and everybody. So this is a time for us to celebrate. Sometimes we look at the glass as half empty. I look at it as half full and looking at all the successful things that have happened in this city with our young people.
So which schools are doing this and can anyone come out?
All of the communities and schools, 22 sites are doing it. And I'm pretty sure all of the Kids Hope Alliance funded programs have some form of after school program. So if you go to the Kids Hope Alliance website, it'll list all the different after school programs they have.
Okay. And you want parents to come, obviously, and kind of enjoy. This is like a party atmosphere.
Yes, yes. And we want parents, we want the community leaders, we want everybody to come. And what they get to do is tour the programs and see exactly what's going on after school with their children and what's going on in the community.
Yeah. So again, this is coming up Thursday in Jacksonville. This is Lights On After School with 22 sites taking part in this national event, all led by communities in schools. They are embedded in schools across the city of Jacksonville to address the needs of the whole child and eliminate barriers to graduation and support these kids once they graduate. So really important work that you are doing in this community, Leon. And, you know, I didn't know that about your personal story.
Yes,
so
yes.
That makes it even more powerful.
Oh, yes. And like I said, I've been there. I've done it. And I understand the importance of caring adults. And I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't those people today. So my job is to pay it forward and do as much as I can for those in need.
Can people volunteer with communities and schools?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can go to our website at cisjacks.org or our phone number is 344-3900. 344-3900. Please, we love volunteers. We want people to come in. And that's one of the biggest challenges. The kids that we're working with have not been exposed to volunteers or mentors or professionals in the area. So anybody that's willing to volunteer, we're willing to take you on.
Yes, go to cisjacks.org, especially if you're a guy. The young men need mentors. As young women need them, of course, but they always need young male mentors, especially. Mm-hmm. So consider volunteering. And Leon Baxton, Chief Operating Officer with Communities and Schools, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
And in a moment, we're going to head out to the beaches where seniors are rocking, living healthy, independent lives with Engage at Any Age. That's next.
This is Ira Glass with This American Life, and I'm coming to Jacksonville to give a talk I call 7 Things I've Learned, which is basically just an excuse to tell a bunch of stories and play clips and play videos and talk about how we make our radio show and talk about stuff we have not put on the air and never will put on the air and just play stuff that it seemed like it would be fun to play for a crowd. It's Saturday, November 10th at Florida Theater, sponsored by Community First Credit Union. Tickets at floridatheater.com. That's floridatheater.com.
Not everything is a business, but you can build a business out of pretty much anything.
We all have different personas that we use, not to the extent that you've created an industry around it, but some do.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the glamorous, the fabulous, the business of drag that RuPaul built. Next time on Marketplace. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
A refugee from Syria wanted to finish high school when she got to the United States. First, she had to learn English.
I did not know what teachers wanted me to do, but I was actually motivated because I wanted, like, from the bottom of my heart to go back to school.
She learned, she excelled, and then she aged out before she could graduate. How age rules push immigrant students out of school on the world. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Anthony Scaramucci remains loyal to the Trump administration despite his brief and rocky tenure as White House communications director. Now he says the personal price for those 10 dramatic days was too high. His book, The Blue Collar President, lays out what he says he got wrong and what Donald Trump got right. Anthony Scaramucci, next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, finally this hour, it's an organization dedicated to helping seniors at the beaches live healthy, independent lives. And that includes mobility, getting around town. Gary Tiller is executive director of the Beaches Council on Aging, and he joins us now. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And, you know, in a moment, we're going to talk about this big event you're having, Engage at Any Age, which is a great name, by the way. But first, let's talk about the Beaches Council on Aging. You do so much for seniors at the beach, including this cool program. It's called Beaches Dial-A-Ride. It's like Uber in a way. but tell me about it.
That's right. And it is a great program, and it's been in existence for 43 years, believe it or not. It's the Council on Aging. Our Beaches Council on Aging is a small nonprofit. We're primarily known for the transportation program Dial-A-Ride, and we provide over 500 seniors per year, individually identified, with about almost 5,000 trips a year for medical appointments, grocery store, pharmacy, hair and nail salon, and even social engagement for arts, theater, whatever they need.
And this is free to them.
It is. If they need it to be free, we do ask for a $5 donation per round trip, but we don't turn anybody down.
That's a good deal.
Yeah.
And this is for seniors at the beaches that just for whatever reason can't drive themselves anymore.
Exactly. One of the biggest needs of senior life all over our country is transportation. And for all kinds of reasons, people live beyond their ability to drive. National studies say that people live something like 7 to 10 years beyond their ability to drive. They lose their license for macular degeneration or physical limitations or whatever. Mm-hmm. So something like a Dial-A-Ride steps in and allows them to continue to have life and independence and be able to use the term age in place, continue to live in their home or their apartment or wherever. And still have that independence to their life.
Having mobility is so important because seniors can get isolated without that. It can be terrifying. This is such a vital thing you're doing.
It's amazing that seniors often do retreat into their homes and isolate and end up dying that way because they lose that social engagement of being able to just get out and go to the grocery store to have the right kind of nutritional food, to go to their medical appointments. And oftentimes we find that we may be able to take a senior to their primary care physician for that appointment, but then they might get recommended to a specialist in another part of town. They don't have a way of getting there or they don't want to go through the process, so they just don't go for the appointment.
Now, people can sign up for Dial-A-Ride pretty easily. They just need to call you.
That's correct.
Right? Just call the number.
That's correct.
It's 904-246-1477. Again, 904-246-1477. And do volunteers do all the drives?
We actually have drivers that are paid, and they're trained and insured. And
the whole thing.
The whole thing, yeah. And they're a great, great bunch of folks that that take care of them.
This is just amazing work. Now, to learn more about the Beaches Council on Aging and have fun, too, you've got an event coming up. It's called Engage at Any Age. This is coming up Monday?
That's right, and we're very excited about it. This is the first of what we hope to be an annual event at the beach to celebrate senior life at the beach. And we've got a lot of fun activities planned. We've got some great live entertainment to be a part of it. Elvis is going to be there.
He's still alive.
He is. Elvis will be in the house.
Elvis is in the building.
That's right. Frank Sinatra, the Florida Chamber Music Project. We'll have a cast from Players by the Sea. It'll be a fun day of informational activity, educational seminars, and great entertainment and great food from a lot of our local beaches restaurants.
And this is coming up Monday, 9:30 a.m. This is open to anyone 65 and older, located at your center, which is?
It's actually located at the Jacksonville Beach Exposition Hall and Community Center, which is off of South Beach Parkway in Osceola.
And if you can't get there, you can use their dial of ride.
That's exactly right. We're going to be hauling people that need rides all day long.
That's right. It's the Beaches Dial a Ride. If you're 65 or older, you can do this. It's 904-246-1477. They turn no one away. And they do ask for a donation, but nobody is turned down. So call them up, be part of this, engage at any age, along with Gary Tiller and his staff. He's the executive director of the Beaches Council on Aging. Gary, thanks so much for being with us.
Melissa, thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Michelle Corum is our director. Our theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. And if you missed anything this morning, just catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is 89.9. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.